The following content is sponsored by Atlantis Sports Clubs and does not reflect the views of WATD Radio. It's Friends with Benefits on 95.9 WATD, exploring relationships, social issues, sports, and life stories. Be a part of the show at 781-837-4900. This is Brian Stratton's Friends with Benefits with your hosts, Paul Kearney, Gabe Sirota, Joe Coletti, and Bob Anderson.
Hello and good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages. Ben Rabinovitz in tonight for Joe Coletti and Michelle Hager as we have a very special episode of Blue Saris for you tonight on Friends with Benefits here on 959 WATD and streaming online at 959WATD.com. We are going to look back with the ATA Conference 2022. It was the 26th anniversary of the American Telehealth Association, and we were there live at the BCEC for just such a special occasion. Join us now as we take a look back at the ATA Conference here in Boston. Your friend Ben here with Blue Saris Consulting, and we've got a lot of friends with us here today. I'm happy to say a lot of familiar ones at that. Miss Iris Berman from Northwell Health joins us first and foremost. Iris, how are you?
Doing well. Excited to be here. It's been a while since we've all been able to get together, so this is a great event. I'm Iris Berman. I'm the Vice President of Telehealth Services for Northwell, which is the largest healthcare provider in New York and the largest employer. And we've been covering telehealth for well over 10 years. We have everything from soup to nuts on the acute care side and the direct-to-consumer side, and I hope we'll get to talk a little bit about that.
Hi, Ben. This is Danielle Lauder with the Northeast Telehealth Resource Center, and we are federally funded through HRSA's Office for the Advancement of Telehealth to provide technical assistance, education, training, you name it, really kind of meeting folks where they're at, from singular providers up to the largest healthcare systems. We actually get the privilege of working with Iris and her team on a number of projects over the years, really to help people get started with telehealth. And I serve the Northeast region, which is the six New England states in New York.
Hi, Ben. I'm Mary Devaney, and I am with the Great Plains Telehealth Resource and Assistance Center. We actually serve the states of North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin. So like Danielle, we are here to basically help people understand what it is they need to know and learn about telehealth and the delivery of those services.
All right, and I get to close us out, I guess. So I'm Lloyd Sermons, and just as my previous two counterparts here, we provide technical assistance around telehealth and telemedicine services. I actually cover the southeastern portion of the United States, so Georgia, along with Alabama, Florida, South Carolina, and most recently Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands as well. So,
first and foremost, the toughest question I could ever ask anyone: how much fun is it working with Blue Saris?
It's been lots of fun, great partners, and a great way to also network and hear what others are doing in the field. It's been a real pleasure.
Great question, Ben. And we've worked with Blue Saris, including Joe Coletti and Michelle Hager, who are kind of up in our region doing collaborative educational type of events and doing warm handoffs when there's a more in-depth maybe project that needs to happen that we can't necessarily provide through the Telehealth Resource Center, doing that warm handoff with the Blue Saris team and vice versa. So we've made a lot of common contacts in that way, and we love to collaborate and help folks throughout the region to get their telemedicine programs up and running.
Yeah, Blue Saris has been great. They've been part of our annual conferences, which we're excited is going to be in person again now this year, this actually end of this month. And the Blue Saris folks have been generous and being able to be part of our exhibit floor and be there for the folks that come and attend our conference and are looking for some additional assistance.
Yeah, I have had the opportunity to work with Joe and Michelle for a number of years. Just, you know, really, I guess, started out seeing them at conferences. You know, we would be at the same conferences exhibiting, and Michelle, of course, you know, always speaking, and then we've had them speak at our conferences as well, you know, over the past couple of years. So, but just, you know, always, it's always a good time, you know, with Joe and with Michelle when we get together with them. They definitely know how to have fun and liven up a crowd. So We just love both.
Yeah, they are some characters, aren't they? I'll tell you that. But they're good. There are characters, and that's what's important. So to the actual telehealth side of our conversation, we're representing very drastically different areas of the country in this panel. So I've got to ask you, and we'll start with you, Ms. Berman, once again. When it comes to rural areas and veterans and getting them connected in your areas, what do you feel the progress is right now from where we started in this pandemic to now here, hopefully at the end of it? How has that progress changed, and how do you feel that it's become a little bit easier, hopefully, for the veterans in your area?
Well, early on, even before the pandemic, one of our first forays into telehealth as we started to launch our direct-to-consumer platform was actually for veterans to provide them emotional and behavioral health support. So we have always recognized the need for that. I think the pandemic has made it much more acceptable to be able to get help for behavioral health needs. We are in a metropolitan statistical area, so we don't have a lot of rural areas, but we certainly have a lot of vets in our area, and I don't care where they're located, they need the help, and telehealth provides that in the comfort of their home and with the support of their family if that's what they need. And so I'm very excited about that extension.
Yes, so the telehealth resource centers are a little bit different, Ben, in that we don't provide direct services. However, we provide technical assistance training to the workforce both for today and for tomorrow. So we've developed trainings for, you know, physicians, nurses, physical therapists, you name it, all the different types of disciplines, so multidisciplinary care, and veterans have most certainly benefited from that and having access to specialty services, to primary care, et cetera. We know how important that care is, and to get veterans connected, all populations really connected. Another thing that we work a lot on, without adequate connectivity, there are telehealth is not there, right? We do have, you know, the public health emergency audio only, telephone only visits have been possible through some policy flexibilities, and that's certainly been a lifesaver, literally, in many instances. But one of the things that we also work on is to help stakeholders, partners get funded for devices for developing for their infrastructure to make sure that people have adequate connectivity. Lots of our veterans in our area live in rural areas, and so we've helped lots of folks to increase their connectivity so that folks like veterans can access telehealth, telemedicine services over these past couple of years.
Yeah, Ben, I think the other piece that we've seen a lot of shift around is in the willingness of providers, especially from the behavioral health and the mental health side of things, to step into telehealth as being something that's a viable service delivery option for them. Before the pandemic, I think a lot of, I would say that our percentage of utilization for telehealth from the behavioral health side of things was not where we wanted it to be. And now, as a result of really them having to get into it, telehealth is part of the standard of care now from the perspective of behavioral health and mental health services. And boy, I tell you what, when you think of things from the rural side of things, there aren't a lot of providers out there. And so to be able to have those providers use the resources that are available to them, whether it's in person or virtual, to serve the patients that they have, to serve the clients that they have, has really been important and really been helpful.
Yeah, I think the big thing with the telehealth, and I know there's been a big push over the past few years with the VA. I mean, we've done, through my parent company, we've done some work with the VA in the past. And, you know, just with the VA wanting to kind of open up their network, because they do have a pretty robust telehealth network. And so just the willingness on their part to see the need to be able to kind of open up that network, to be able to allow, you know, veterans in a lot of these rural areas to be able to use existing telehealth networks and, you know, originating sites, which is where the patient would be, you know, was really a big step, especially for, you know, a lot of the states that I cover. You know, there's a lot of rural places and patients, you know, having access. So being able to bring the physician to the patient where they are, I think, is huge. As Mary was saying, you know, such a shortage of providers, and especially in the mental health area. And so that's just kind of one of the things that we have seen over the past few years. Of course, you know, the VA is pushing to try to provide care, and I think telehealth is really one of those that can bridge the gap and kind of help mitigate some of the disparities that we see in the care that that particular population sees.
My next question, and once again going back to Ms. Berman to start, with the advent now of telehealth being normalized, do you think that this will be the spark that might get some of the next generation doctors interested in medical school once again? As we all know, the numbers have been drastically down, and the doctors that are here with us still, they're dropping like flies, unfortunately. So is this the avenue that we've been waiting for to hopefully see that next wave of doctors enter into the realm?
I think as long as you design thoughtfully, it will, any piece of technology that improves their work and allows them more time at home, which has been a big thing, of course, during the pandemic. The doctors were burnt out from long hours, from difficulty in arranging seeing their patients, and certainly telehealth helped that. That, along with recognizing quality of life and, limiting those hours during the day, because no matter how you do it, you still need to have that downtime. But this certainly would reduce some of their windshield time for some of the certain appointments, such as their bundled appointments, to allow them to have those margins of time to do everything that's being asked of them, as long, again, as we design thoughtfully in those programs. But I think any technology will expand that ability.
I would absolutely agree with Iris, and, clearly I've drunk the Kool-Aid with respect to telehealth and how important it is, but it's a tool in the toolbox, right? And it needs to be designed with the end users in mind. That includes both providers, physicians, nurse practitioners, all the different providers, and patients as well. So the whole philosophy of nothing about us without us, when you're developing your program, make sure that you're asking for input from your providers. And it doesn't have to be fancy. It has to work consistently, effectively, right? So it's all those things that us telehealth resource centers get these questions all the time, making sure that it's a high quality visit. And then they don't have to think about that to make it happen, right? It just, like Iris said, it has to be carefully planned, and the technology has to work. We are seeing, as I mentioned earlier, we've been working with a lot of colleges and universities in this area, in this region, to help them build telehealth training, effective telehealth training, so that people are feeling very confident and competent in using it to deliver care to patients when they enter the workforce. So we're really excited about that working upstream. We've been doing a little bit of that, snippets before COVID, but now it's like part, I think the expectation is that it's going to be part of the core curriculum for tomorrow's healthcare workforce, which is great.
Yeah, and what Danielle said, I think, is really important from the perspective of that incoming provider group. They now have an understanding too that it's like, okay, this has got to be part of what I do, and how do I do it well? And I think the other piece too is understanding that their support team needs to understand what it is and how to do it well. So it's understanding the workflow of pieces and parts. So Who is the person who would have greeted them at the door? How do we do that virtually? Who is the person that would have scheduled their visit following their appointment? How do we do that virtually? And incorporating all those pieces and parts into that entire package, supporting the provider and supporting that patient.
Yeah, so, one of the things that some of the schools that we work with down kind of in the region that I cover, schools like Mercer University and, Emory and some of Augusta, we're all trying to figure that out, I think. And our states are addressing, Georgia, for example, is pouring money into student loan forgiveness and things like that. So I think there's a big picture that really has to be looked at. And I think technology can play a small role in that. Because I think it can alleviate some of the burden that many of our physicians are facing. But I really think at the end of the day, what we're seeing now, and I think what the pandemic really shone a light on, is that we've got a healthcare system that really isn't working right now. It hasn't worked, and so there needs to be some changes. And for whatever reason, we've allowed technology. Technology just inserts itself into our lives. It's the way technology is. Every aspect of our life, whether it's our automobiles, our homes, different things. For whatever reason, healthcare was slow to really adapt and adopt kind of technology. And I think that's what we're seeing now. We're seeing this technology really insert itself and force itself into healthcare. Policy has been very slow to change and adapt to allow that, but it's happening. And I think it can make a big difference, especially with this younger generation who is accustomed and comfortable with using technology.
Excellent points all around, and thank you very much. I just want to pass around just an opportunity for some final thoughts here as we wrap up this Q&A with this wonderful four-person panel. What is something that you would like the free world to know about telehealth services that they would never know unless you tell them right here, right now? Take a moment to think about that.
Oh, sure. Make me first. So I think understanding what parity means and being aware of what their coverage contains. I don't think a lot of people realize that telehealth might actually be covered by their policy. And so might afford them that need for care as opposed to them waiting and getting sicker. I think they also should realize that telehealth is a way to de-escalate a problem and prevent hospitalizations, and they should feel more comfortable with the technology and not be embarrassed to ask for help. Most programs will help support you to use it. So I think those are two big take-homes.
Wow. I feel like certainly, I was just talking with somebody earlier that, you know, pre-COVID, the number of articles around telehealth and COVID-19, et cetera, was like this much smaller number. And then, so I feel like we've learned a whole lot. So me thinking that I know something that somebody else doesn't, I don't know, that's a lot to ask. But I guess it's just maybe to talk about the importance of personalization. Just like in-person care, it's about the providers, it's about the patients, right? It's not the right fit for everybody. It's not the right fit for every use case. You have to look at all the different factors with respect to connectivity, with respect to developmental disabilities, physical disabilities, et cetera. It needs to be person-centric. And so I think I would just kind of hammer that home, but it's an incredible tool, and we have seen literally life-saving, quality of life improvements, massive increases in access to care. So, you know, we know it's this incredible tool. Yes, we have to continue to expand permanent policy that allows us to leverage telehealth moving forward. But I think as long as we, just like, you know, our healthcare system needs to look at the person and person-centric care, it's the same with telehealth. So I guess I would hammer that point home.
Yeah, really important. You know, I think the piece that I would share is that you can do it. Telehealth, you can do it. If you haven't yet, you can do it. It's something that there's a piece for telehealth in just about everything that can be done. Not that it can do everything, but there is a component. And be willing to think outside of the normal delivery method, the delivery processes. I mean, how do we, you know, are we looking at how we continue to support school-based services? How do we support veterans in their home communities? Some of these very small communities, you know, are there opportunities that you haven't considered? Are there partners you haven't considered? Those are things I think that this has really shifted our thought on, and I'm excited to see kind of what comes down the pike soon.
Yeah, I think I'll just kind of reiterate the fact that, you know, telemedicine's not a fit for everything. I mean, and just as you've heard here, just with, you know, with both of these, you know, who spoke before me, it's not going to fit every situation and every scenario. And everybody, I always say this, everybody's not a telemedicine candidate or a candidate for telemedicine. I think one of the things we saw with the pandemic was, just because everybody has a smartphone or a cell device, it doesn't necessarily mean they know how to use that device. So there's still a lot of education that needs to be done around this. But, you know, the flip side is when you start talking about, you know, health disparities and you look at just where we are with the number of people who, you know, who are lacking adequate health care, you know, and there's a correlation we're now seeing between, you know, inadequate broadband, like what we consider to be these broadband deserts, and then health disparities as well. So we're figuring all of this out, you know, and those two seem to be lining up. So we've got things we need to work on. But I'll go back to a comment I said earlier. the way technology kind of inserts itself into our lives, you know, this is kind of one of those things where, and I say this, I've said it for years, and I say it in all my talks, you know, there's really two types of people. There are those who are doing telemedicine, and there are those that will be doing telemedicine. So it's not a matter of if. I mean, it's just really a matter of when. And I think, you know, that's kind of, you know, that's just kind of a thought that I think I'd like to leave with that.
Cannot thank you all enough individually, one by one, for being with us here on this amazing four-person panel. Just wanted to say thank you very much. And on behalf of BlueCirrus Consulting, enjoy the rest of the conference today. Thank you very much, folks. We're joined now by UMass Memorial Medical Center's Mr. Eric Cucci. Welcome and thank you for joining us here today. Tell the folks at home a little bit about yourself.
Thanks, Ben. My name is Eric Cucci. I am a physician assistant in critical care, as well as my current position is a director of EICU operations at UMass Memorial Medical Center.
Excellent. We're also being joined by Ms. Teresa Rincon, back from the BlueCirrus team. Thank you for joining us again, Teresa.
So glad to be here and so great to get a chance to catch up with Eric Cucci and all the great work he's been doing.
What's going on, first of all, over at UMass? Telehealth leading the way here in 2022. What have you been able to see from your perspective from the beginning of this pandemic to here now coming up on the end of this process? Your perspective.
Well, first of all, I hope it's the end. So I have a unique position. I've been the director of EICU operations for 5 years, but I've been working in the EICU as a clinician for 15. So I've been involved for much longer than just the pandemic. So I've seen the transition from before, during, and after. From my perspective, I like to break it up into three different groups. In the before time, we really thought we had it under control in terms of we, the global telehealth community. We knew we had data to support the, its importance in terms of quality measures. We had data to support its financial success as well. And we had patient data saying that, you know, patients liked it and clinicians liked it. And we really thought we had a great product and that the future was bright but very far off in the distance. Fast forward to 2000 and our ideas of what telehealth was and should be changed dramatically and almost overnight. It was pretty well established that nationally we weren't prepared for a large-scale pandemic and increased surging. So almost overnight, we had to transition very quickly to a telehealth solution in order to manage patients who weren't only infected with coronavirus, but also patients who needed routine care. So overnight, we needed increased devices. We need many more devices. And everyone was scrambling for devices at the same time. So you started to see shortages in things like microphones and webcams. And then we were able to work with a lot of our local vendors to try to be able to find the larger devices to be able to do telemedicine. Luckily, at UMass Memorial, we were able to partner with Caregility, and we were able to purchase 100 carts. We were one of the first ones in the country to receive their new telemedicine carts, and we were able to utilize those to address ICU surging. I think in the initial days, we had over 60 beds of ICU surge capacity that we needed to address. And we needed to put a camera in front of each one of those patients to be able to give them the same support as our traditional ICU patients who have had cameras at the bedside since about 2006. Other interesting things that we found during the coronavirus pandemic was that we found that telemedicine wasn't just what we had anticipated prior and what we had been doing traditionally for the last 10 years before didn't fully encompass the need that we found in the short term. So, for instance, we found that with the coronavirus, we needed to isolate patients, and patients needed to be isolated from friends, families, visitors weren't coming into the hospitals any longer. So patients were starting to get isolation syndromes. And there was a number of different articles, whether it was in the Boston Globe or published in the medical literature, about patients really suffering from isolation and really feeling depressed and having difficulties managing the fact that they weren't talking to anyone. And the people that they were talking to were the healthcare providers that were coming in fully gowned and fully dressed. So one of the things that came early on, and Dr. Rincon did a lot of work in this area, was being able to get iPads and telemedicine devices to the bedside to be able to just connect patients, whether it was via FaceTime, whether it was via Skype or Zoom or whatever, but be able to connect families. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Sure, yeah. We partnered with Eric's team and also with our technical partners to put together and configure and deliver these devices. We delivered, I think in the first wave, we delivered over 800 iPads to clinical units for the purpose that Eric Cucci just described. So it was very helpful. We also gave these to teams. Everyone from our palliative care teams to our chaplains had devices so that if they were in working with patients, they could connect them with family members, even for end-of-life care, and to make sure that they got a chance to say goodbye. So it was very rewarding and difficult time, but a very rewarding time. So one of the other things I wanted to ask you, Eric, though, was about some of the things you saw. How did you see the bedside clinicians using those devices, those carts that you put in the room, as well as you had devices on the walls in your ICU rooms? How did they use those technologies to become more efficient and to reduce maybe some of the PPE utilization?
Yeah, that was a really interesting finding then when we looked at the data post analysis. But what we had found was that with the devices that were already mounted on the walls, as well as the devices that we had gotten to be able to adapt to the surge capacity, it was very early on in 2020. And at that time, if you recall, PPE was at an extreme shortage. It was really hard for hospitals to get PPE. And a lot of hospitals were asking their facilities and their workers to save their N95s and reuse N95s and be able to be judicious with their PPE. And what we ended up seeing was that the bedside teams, not just the remote EICU teams, but the bedside teams were actually using the cameras to evaluate their patients. And we saw an 800% increase in the usage of bedside camera activity to evaluate the patients. And you can actually see this trend up and then trend down several months later as the PPE shortage improved and there was more PPE to be available so that people felt more comfortable with getting into utilizing PPE and rather than reusing it over and over again, and they were able to get into the rooms and evaluate the patients. So there was a really dramatic increase in usage at the bedside. One other thing I wanted to mention that we found when we were looking at this time was that in addition to the isolation syndrome and patients wanting to talk to their families, we also found that there was a need for just entertainment. I mean, there's so many reruns that you can watch on hospital television that before you start to get sick of it. So one of the things that really we found was that telemedicine and telehealth isn't just telemedicine and telehealth anymore. It's really this digital health experience where there is digital health tools, whether it be even Netflix or Hulu or some sort of bedside entertainment system that allows for streaming, website access, social media access, but also access to your friends and family via video conference, as well as clinicians being able to go in and evaluate their patients, as well as patients are able to speak to their clinicians. This really kind of expanded the role of telemedicine to this much larger dimension that's sometimes referred to as digital health.
a lot goes into the whole process of not only developing the software that is going to go on these iPads that were so difficult to acquire the first time around anyway. Can you speak to how that process came about? And did you guys ever end up talking to, say, the AV crew from the UMass Memorial Medical Center? And who else was really involved in the designing of the software?
So it's a great question because it involves much more than clinicians and administrators just to decide that you want to do telehealth. You really need a robust IS support. And whether that is in the early stages of development and you're working with vendors that are in this sphere, or it's just in the ongoing maintenance. These packages, these software products need upgrades. They need maintenance. They need troubleshooting when something goes awry. So it really is a collaborative effort between the clinicians, the administrators, and IS as well.
When I think, too, what we tapped into quickly were folks that were kind of out of a job when the pandemic hit. So one of the big groups that we found at UMass was the transformation specialist. So those are those people that are working on projects from a lean methodology standpoint. Some of those projects that they're working on got put on hold. So there was only a handful of real true telehealth experts, Eric being one of them and myself, in the organization. So I basically took about 5 master black belt lean specialists and trained them to lead several wings of our program. And they just took off and ran with it. So it was amazing. We ended up with a small army of people that we trained to help us. I also had an amazing project manager, Jonathan Penault, who was able to work with the IS and IT teams to put together a strategy to get our configuration of the iPads. It was about 20 minutes an iPad from the time we got it off the loading dock and the box into the hand of somebody to open it up and then get an Apple ID on it, etc., get it ready, put the apps on it that we needed app. We got that from 20 minutes down to 12 minutes. By just using lean methods and meeting with the team and listening to the people doing the work. And I think that's the important thing. And Eric did the same thing. He worked side by side with his system analyst, Greg Wonkam, and they actually built the carts, put them together, configured them, delivered them to the ICUs, the surge, the brand new ICUs, and set them up. So it really took an army of people working in collaboration. Eric couldn't have done what he had did alone, and I couldn't have done what I needed to do alone. We did it with the team.
Teamwork does make that dream work. It's a bit of a habit, isn't it? Anybody else you'd like to give a special shout-out to? Obviously, a very specialized team that we're talking about here right now. I want to take a moment. You're just going to give a shout-out to some of those folks?
Sure. No, it's hard to pick out individuals during this time. It was such a large team effort. The entire virtual medicine team that Teresa worked with, the EICU team that I worked with, and a lot of the other a lot of members of IS and project management all really got together to really kind of work together to really pull this off in an almost overnight manner. Whereas, you know, just opening up the kind of releasing the bureaucratic tape and just everyone rolling up their sleeves and getting it done, it really was truly amazing.
Well, I'll call a couple out by name because he's done the broader one. So Dave Smith, who's the vice president of telehealth at UMass Memorial. We couldn't have accomplished what we accomplished without his support and guidance. Maria Ayek, who's one of the system analysts for telehealth, did an amazing job of really teaching a whole bunch of people how to use the technology really fast. So we couldn't have done it without her as well. From the transformation team, there's a whole handful of them, but Kim McGuigan was instrumental in really leading the charge with that group. So I don't know, can you think of anybody else, Eric? I mean, there were so many people who helped us.
It's really hard.
It's hard to think of them, but we definitely had a small army that we taught how to be telehealth experts in a matter of weeks.
Truly the elite and the few, and thank you to everyone. If we forgot your name, that's okay, because you're definitely on the website. And Eric, I'm going to turn it back to you. Where can people find that information? Just giving credit to the whole team overall. Where can people find more information about your team and what you guys have been able to do and where you're going in the future?
Thanks. I think starting with www.umassmemorial.org is probably the best place to start going down the pathway and finding out more information about us.
Just real quick, final thought question for both of you, and Dr. Rincon, you can go first. What is one thing that nobody out there in the free world would know about telehealth that, unless they heard it right from your lips right now, they're never going to know?
Wow, that's a good one. Well, I can just say I was on what I would call the bleeding edge of telehealth, starting the first tele-ICU on the West Coast, the second in the nation. So really starting from the bottom and working our way up and help to actually shape the and articulate the practice of tele-ICU nursing.
I think that telemedicine is really in a transformational stage. It has moved, as I mentioned, to this digital health strategy. And I think that along with that comes a larger degree in usage of data analytics of both traditional big data as well as big data science, as well as artificial intelligence, machine learning, to really develop very sensitive and specific tools that will help telemedicine make larger scale decisions for the population health management as well as individual patients.
Couldn't have said that if I tried. So thank you very much for making that easy for all of us, my friend. Mr. Eric Cucci here from the UMass Memorial Medical Center out in Worcester, Massachusetts. And, of course, Dr. Teresa Rincon, Blue Cirrus Consulting. Thank you guys so much for taking the time to join us here today at the ATA conference. And have a great rest of the day. And enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Blue Cirrus Consulting, your friend Ben here, and we have got some great friends alongside us here doing a bunch of great things in the world of telehealth. My friend, welcome, and if you could introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them a little bit about yourself and what your company does.
Hi, I'm Frank Seitz. I'm the Vice President of Connected Care for Jefferson Health in Philadelphia. My role is to oversee all the telehealth activities for the enterprise, including all urgent care activities.
Hello, my name is Teresa Rincon, and I am a senior telehealth consultant for Blue Cirrus Consulting, and I'm also an assistant professor at the Graduate School of Nursing at the UMass Medical School.
Thank you for joining us. Now, Mr. Seitz, if I could, we've had you on the show in the past, and that was a wonderful interview. Can you tell us a little bit more about what your company is doing moving forward as we are almost, I hate to say it, halfway through 2022 already?
Yes, thank you. So the last time we spoke, we were talking about what COVID will look like and how we were preparing and taking a disaster management approach. As time played out, we pretty much got a lot of that correct, maybe by just good fortune or maybe by the fact that many of the folks within my department have an emergency medicine background, and thus planning and disaster planning is pretty much in our DNA. The role that we've taken over time, to give you an idea, you know, prior to COVID, we saw about 1% of our total ambulatory volume was conducted through telehealth. In the first month or so following COVID, it was up around 85-90%. And probably since that time for the last year, we've held between, you know, 12-13% of our total volume. So what we've done over time is we've really taken a holistic approach at how we monitor patients, how we engage patients, and largely how we educate patients on how this is a viable way that they can get their health care.
So piggybacking a little bit off of what Frank talked about, I was working with UMass Memorial Medical Center and their affiliated hospitals in the middle of COVID to really figure out how were we going to work around the situation of protecting people, not having people come into the hospital that didn't need to, from both the patient and provider standpoint. How would we provide that care? So we were able to quickly stand up not only outpatient but inpatient services. We were able to secure over 100 telemedicine carts that we could put in the inpatient side. This allowed us to have the same level of care for our tele-ICU patients that we already saw at over 120 beds in our health system. And we were able to jump that up by about adding another 20-30% of the beds, creating new ICU surge environments. We were also able to secure about 1,400 iPads and use telehealth services from several different vendors and able to connect patients and families together when the patient was in the hospital, as well as use some of these applications to connect providers to patients while they were at home.
And I'll pose this question back to Frank here. In the process of getting all of this figured out from the get-go of COVID to where we are nowadays, hopefully near just about the end of all this, how rewarding has it been for you personally to be able to see how connecting patients and doctors in the future here with telehealth has really impacted the family well-being overall?
Thank you. So it's very rewarding. It's prior to COVID, we would look at how we manage patients, and we will more so look at how we manage our providers that provided the care for patients. We didn't know where this was going to go long term. We spoke about telehealth for years and years with relatively low volume, low adoption, low engagement. We spent much of our time in our organization at Jefferson Health talking about debunking the myths of telehealth. We would talk to people about why it was easy, how you can engage in it, why your patients want it. We talked a little bit about payment and payment parity, and that has been a little more of a tricky subject to navigate. But when you go literally overnight from 1% of your ambulatory volume to 85-90% of your volume, clearly there's engagement, whether it's because of a pandemic or whether it's because people truly are open to it. But the ongoing engagement with our providers has been one of education. And by educating our providers, they're more inclined to engage. They're more inclined to think through their process for how they're managing patients. And they're thinking more creatively about what it means to their patients and how it actually makes their workflow a lot easier. This for us has been, like I said, rewarding, and we've been able to scale this, over 18 hospitals in our health system, and there's various levels of engagement and adoption, and it just continues to grow. So, we're still at a great time in the telehealth, ecosystem.
Well, I think I want to talk a little bit about adoption. I think that although we're seeing an amazing amount of improved adoption, and really telehealth has become mainstream, everyone's talking about it, I think we still need to study adoption. We need to evaluate what are the things, the steps, the tools that we're using, and how do they make us more efficient and effective as caregivers. We need to make sure we keep that efficiency at the top, because if we don't, we're going to end up going backwards instead of forwards. And from the same token, we need to look at what are we asking our patients to do, and can they do it? And I think the other thing that's so important is when we look at equitable care, we have to think about which patient populations are we targeting. Are we leaving somebody out because we're using a technology that an entire population of patients is unable to use? So then what do we do to fill that gap? What other technologies? How do we get people connected with devices, with internet service? How do we make sure that we're not leaving anybody by the wayside as we start to think about how we create this ecosystem of telehealth and make sure that it is equitable?
Excellently said. Thank you very much. I only have one last question for you folks, and hopefully this one's an easy one. How much fun has it been working with Blue Sirius Consulting?
I think it's been phenomenal. I mean, the team at Blue Sirius is engaging. They're well-known. They understand how to get to solve the problems. They take a practical approach in how they provide their consulting. And that's something that overall is something that we all need. We all need to be able to fundamentally get to an easy approach on how to navigate the tides for what telehealth looks like, and they've been able to achieve that.
Well, I obviously enjoy working with Blue Sirius because that's why I joined their team as a senior telehealth consultant. So I can tell you I'm enjoying the journey working with them. It's an amazing team of experts, and we have someone who could answer almost any question, maybe any question, related to telehealth.
Wonderfully said. It's been an absolute pleasure having both of you here with us here today at the 26th year anniversary here of the ATA conference. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Good evening and welcome back. Blue Saris Telehealth Consulting, right here on WATD 959 FM and streaming online at 959WATD.com. We are going to continue our conversations with all of our guests featured on the ATA conference, and we've met up with a few folks that have been on the show in past episodes, and we were happy to have them back on here again tonight. We're at the BCEC, and we're now with Mr. Greg Mann. He's got some great news for the deaf community and telehealth. Greg, first of all, thank you for joining us here. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your company.
Oh, thanks, Ben. I appreciate that. Yeah, so I'm Greg Mann. I'm the Director of Business Development for a company called Communication Service for the Deaf, or CSD. We've been around for about 45 years now. We work with the deaf community very extensively. We provide different types of services, technology, and so on to the deaf community throughout the country. Recently, we've created a program called Health Science of Virtual Care. It's a deaf telehealth system, which now allows the deaf patient to speak directly with a deaf physician or a provider trained in American Sign Language. This will, of course, help eliminate a lot of the complications currently associated with the communication between the physician and the patient. Most importantly, we eliminate a lot of the problems associated with misdiagnoses, which is extremely high amongst the deaf population. Once we eliminate misdiagnoses, we also eliminate a lot of other problems, including the unnecessary need to go to the emergency room, which is literally twice as high among the deaf community. In addition to that, we eliminate lab and diagnostic tests. We eliminate the length of time in hospital settings and readmission settings to the hospital as well. In doing so, of course, we do two things. Number one, and most importantly, we improve the outcome of the patient population for the deaf community. And number two, of course, we eliminate a lot of the complications on a long-term basis, which means we eliminate a lot of the costs associated with the treatment and care.
That's wonderful. So at the end of the day here, your company is doing something that not many others have even considered in remembering our friends in the deaf community. Can you speak to how much that impact has been on the folks you've been able to see and talk to so far, but the positivity that's brought about?
Yeah, thanks, Ben. It's been extremely important, and it's been very positive. We've had an opportunity to speak with a number of presidents associated with different deaf organizations in New York and in Texas and elsewhere, and the response has been incredible. I mean, they're currently using a system called VRI, video remote interpreting, where a patient actually has to speak with a physician through an interpreter. There's a problem with that inherently because a lot of the interpreters aren't trained in medical terminology, anatomy, and so on. So there's an issue there with miscommunication, and that's created many problems. So we have found that the response, again, has been extremely high. They're very excited about the program and eager for it to be released in New York and Texas. Initially, we're going to be doing a pilot program between 400 and 500 patients for maybe 4 or 5, 6 months maybe to determine the overall ease of use for the platform that we're using, but a lot of other questions related to the response or the communication process between the patient and the physician.
So, needless to say, bright horizons in front of us and our friends in the deaf community will finally be heard effectively.
Absolutely. They've been ignored way too long, and this is going to make a huge impact and a difference in the deaf community.
Wonderful. Is there a website or anywhere that folks can find more information about what's going on?
Absolutely. CSD.org. O-R-G. We'll have a lot of information there regarding the new program. It hasn't been released yet. It will be released sometime in the August-September timeframe, but up until now, that's where you go to learn more about it.
Wonderful. Anything that you would like the folks listening at home to know that I would never have been able to think to ask you other than this moment?
I don't think so, Ben. I have a lot of private personal questions, but I'm sure you won't get into that.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak to our listeners. We appreciate you greatly and enjoy yourself here at the ATA conference.
Thank you, Ben. It's been a pleasure. You have a great day.
In partnership with Blue Saris Consulting, and we're here with Miss Angie Stevens from Iron Bow out of Herndon, Virginia. And first of all, Miss Stevens, thank you for joining us this afternoon. Absolute pleasure to have you here. If you could tell the listeners at home a little bit about your company and what you guys do.
Thank you so much. So I'm Angie Stevens. I'm the Chief Strategy Officer for Iron Bow Technologies. I've been with the company about a year, been in healthcare IT my entire career. Prior to joining Iron Bow, I was with Kaiser Permanente, where I ran the enterprise-wide digital health programs. So been in the industry for quite some time, been coming to ATA quite a bit. So excited to see it back here in person. From an Iron Bow perspective, what we do is we provide digital technologies and clinical endpoints to customers based on their existing needs, where they're headed with their digital strategy. And right now, we mostly work with federal contracts. So you may have heard of us through the Veterans Administration. Their Office of Connected Care is a very large telehealth program that we support.
Excellent. And I'm glad you brought that up because that's my next question for you. What is Iron Bow able to do to help connect the veterans to the telehealth services that are quite literally brand new for everybody?
Yeah, so the Veterans Administration has actually been very progressive. Prior to the pandemic, they had already established a pretty significant telehealth program, even including the distribution of tablets to very remote veterans in need of care. Those tablets included peripheral devices so that when a physician is meeting with them, they're able to actually check their vital signs, do their blood pressure, those types of things. So Iron Bow Technologies brings that together and delivers those out to veterans, and the VA is running right now somewhere around 50,000 video visits a day. So obviously that accelerated dramatically during the pandemic, but since then it's really maintained and continues to grow. And they're looking at more innovation to deploy over the next couple years.
Glad to know that Iron Bow is helping the VA get these kinds of things in place so that the veterans can get those services that we say it all the time on the station. A lot of folks that served aren't even aware of a quarter of the services that are actually available to them simply because they've already served. And a lot of folks have that mentality of, well, I don't want to take away from somebody else. How has Iron Bow kind of helped make that transition a bit easier for veterans to maybe not feel like they are in fact taking something from someone else when they're not?
So I think the VA themselves does a pretty good job of marketing, and they still want to do more as far as reaching veterans who may not be aware that their service is available to them. I think this past couple years, we've seen a real uptick in the need for behavioral health. And so that's another area that the VA has been very progressive in reaching out and trying to help veterans with those challenges, either post-deployment or just simply through COVID or family issues, things like that that have come up. So again, we provide the technology that supports those kinds of programs. We also provide training. We provide support from a technology sense. So if a veteran's having trouble with their tablet, they can call us, or we actually proactively call them and make sure that they're all set up and ready to go and everything's working.
Where can folks find out more information about Iron Bow and the services that they're connected with?
Yeah, you can go to ironbowhealthsolutions.com, and that will give you more information about who we are. You'll see a solution called IronMed, which is where digital health comes together, and that's where we package together our software services and our endpoint devices to create that comprehensive solution that a lot of customers are looking for.
Wonderful. Is there anything else you'd like to share with the people listening in the free world right now?
That's a broad audience. I think the only thing I would like to say is that, you know, a lot of people have felt like coming into the pandemic that this was a blip in the radar for telehealth, that it would kind of go away once the pandemic went away. But it really hasn't. It's shifted the way care is being delivered. It's becoming more part of people's everyday lives. And as a healthcare system starts moving towards the whole value-based care model, these types of technologies will be more proliferated throughout our communities, and looking forward to just continuing to support people in their health.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Ms. Stevens, for joining us here today, and I do hope you enjoy the rest of the conference. Live here at the BCEC for the ATA 26th anniversary, here with Blue Cirrus Consulting.